With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello again, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for another Motorsport Magazine podcast, wherever you are, whether you're on the train, in the car, or going for a jog. Emanuele Pirro emailed me to say that he saves up all our Motorsport Magazine podcasts and listens to them on his long-distance flights. Thank you, Emanuele. It's great. We need all of you, and thanks for your support. Today we have a very, very special guest. We have a world champion. We have a man who's won the Le Mans 24-hour race 9 times, a man who won the German Formula 3 championship, and a man who started his career in Denmark. Not many people have made it to a world championship from Denmark. Fantastic. Welcome, Tom Christensen.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's get straight into it, Tom. Your dad was into hot rod and rallycross, I think, wasn't he? Is that how you first sort of got the smell of petrol and the desire for speed?
I'm born on the gas station, and being, and then with him being racing, and that camaraderie they had after working hours, working on his cars, mainly like Ford Escorts and cars from that era. But this is what I remember.
Okay. But I think your mother tried to persuade you to get a proper job. Is that right?
Yeah. She wanted me to, like every good mom, try to tell you kindly that one out of a million won't make it as a professional race car driver or make a living out of that. But at the same time, it also gave me a little bit of, you know, you're sitting at for breakfast dealing with your muesli or cornflakes, and your mom is already walking around explaining how difficult it is, but you just lift you from the little bit of the Donald Duck book you are reading, just up and get eye contact with your dad, and you just immediately feel that you have a partner in crime, and you can still work hard towards your dream of becoming a race car driver. But it was a dream very early on, and for sure for many years it was a struggle during school times, from karting, breaking into cars.
You went into karting, which is what everybody does now. What is it, Tom, about karting that's so important right at the beginning there? What is it you learn that you take into the future?
I think it's the karting. It's you're growing up as a human being. You learn the respect between your the fellow boys and girls on the track. And it's I think you can ask any racing driver, and if they're really honest, they will say the best time they've had is probably during the karting times, where because you're growing up and you're learning all the things, you're racing each other hard, but at the same time you deal with each other. What I don't like is sort of parents at the karting circuits, and I can honestly say my dad left me alone, but it was not necessarily because he didn't support me, but that was mainly because of he didn't have the budget, the money to support me. So the people who helped me, they should also work directly with me on the track. But I think over these years, is where any driver matures obviously the most, because you're going through the teens. I look back at this time incredibly pleasantly, and also back then we were staying in tents, so we were in the Ford Transit or the Mercedes van or whatever. We were staying in these. We had made sleeping cabins in the back of the seat, so we could also just change driver when we went down through Europe to Italy. And some, I would say, my debut behind a steering wheel on a big van I had there, and. And obviously, I didn't drive karting when I was 18. So, without saying that, it certainly was things you could do back then. And I think you mature very much in that environment. And maybe it's not like this today, but I just think that was personally, it was a golden era or golden time for me when I did karting worldwide or particularly in Europe.
A lot of racing drivers sort of carry on karting to keep their eye in. I mean, even Formula One drivers go off and do some karting. Did you do that later in your career, or once you finished karting, was that it?
No, I sometimes went back, but I have not been back competing, really. I mean, I do every year, I do an indoor Grand Prix. Mainly it's a rental karts. Sometimes we have a bit of a show karts there, but I do a mini Le Mans this I have done for many years with my sponsors, with people from the press or simply friends. I mix it up during the winter, and wherever we are, we have a nice Grand Prix over 2.4 hours, which is and we are then 3, 4, 5 per team. But I got from Michelin a very nice present, winning Le Mans in. I think it was the Bentley victory from Michelin. They gave us the three drivers. They gave us a kart, and obviously that's a very nice present. Yeah. And with that was a shifter 125, because I didn't do shifter when I was doing karting, but I used that, and that was a good help towards DTM. Doing that often, and I did that with when my young oldest son was doing a little bit of karting. So we had a lot of fun from that too. But karting, you can always go back, and it's always what ignites you in direct contact, and you always have to work hard. It gets to you, and it's simply it's a great machine.
It's interesting to me that it all started with you in Denmark, obviously. I mean, not England, not America, not one of the big centres of motor racing. How difficult was it for you to sort of break out of Denmark into international racing? Because it's not a country that has a tremendous, it's not the biggest passion in Denmark.
No, it's, I would say it was for sure that time, which took a long time to establish myself after I thought of wanted to go into car racing. So actually I had these 2 years where I drove a test there, sometimes a race and few tests in different machinery. I even drove a Tracer Cup, I drove a Opel Lotus test, I did a Formula 3 test. I did a little bit of Formula 4 2000 with Jesper Willemsen's team in Denmark. But then I went back, did karting, and I finished second in the world in a karting championship. But that was 2 years after I actually stopped. Yeah. Yeah. But then I had a comeback back then. And so I would say I had 3 years where I didn't have a permanent drive. So close to 1,000 days, it was a struggle to see. And my mom was getting more and more focused on getting me the bank job. And I actually I got my education as a bank club. So my mom was incredibly happy back then. And then 1991. I got this call from Bert Schaefer in Formula 3, and that sort of was another big stepping stone for me. And he signed me for the German F3 Championship the year after. Yeah, Michael Schumacher, friends, and Wendlinger, and all these guys have competed for the crown. So to go in there, I knew it was really the best championship I could get to. Winning the first race, winning the championship back then. Yeah. Was incredibly nice. But I remember already at Christmas in 1991, my mom said, after we had the first the starter, what you have the riz à la main, we call it, we have like a rice pudding, I guess you call it.
Okay, yeah.
I remember you said, Tom, you have fulfilled your dream. You win German Formula 3. Are you thinking about retiring and focusing full on your bank job?
Well, thank goodness you didn't go and work in a bank, eh? Anyway, she had your best, she had the best thing in mind for you, I know. Macau, you went to Macau. What a fantastic place to race. I mean, it's just, even to watch is so thrilling. How did you learn that track? Because there's a lot of corners there, aren't there?
I think, I don't know if you want to touch on that, but I think very first time I went there, imagine, I don't know, 22 years old. I was a bit older as I struggled all these years to get into F3. But going there, it was a fantastic place to go. There was so much traffic back then everywhere. You couldn't go, and there was basically you could buy fruit camps, or it was just you couldn't get a flow on the track, and it was incredibly hot. Then Kurt Thiem told me, he was there with a DTM car. Yeah. He told me, we have jet lag. We will wake up anyway. Go and sleep now, and we will wake up in the night, and we meet here at the reception. I think it was something like 4 o'clock at night, and we woke up, and then we took then Mini Moke, and we drove around the track at during the late hours of Macau.
Good idea.
It was a good idea, and we were both very fast. I remember we were both fast in the free practice. We dropped a bit down. I think I finished fifth at the race, but Macau, anyway, that's your question. It's a fantastic circuit, and it just you just have to. It's fast, and then at the same time incredibly technical, and it's long, so it takes these, I don't know, two and a half minutes or whatever, until you are back again to the same place. And then it's changed always. A lot of blind corners, bumpy like very, and it's great.
And one mistake and that's it at Macau, really, isn't it?
But if you are thinking too much, you are slow. So you're very much, that's any driver who has been to Macau, they like it. And it really gets to them. It needs full attention.
Am I right in thinking you'd learnt some of the circuit on a rickshaw? When you first got there?
But that's what we started. We started with a rickshaw. We had to be in there, but then we couldn't go anywhere because that was the only thing we could. But the full story is we woke up at night and we took the Mini Moke. And that was sort of the secret. I think I told the rickshaw because that will mean that the others, they will start try to learn it in the rickshaw, which we tried as well. Everyone tried that, but maybe I forgot to tell we woke up at night.
You went to Japan. In fact, I think you went for 5 seasons to Japan.
Yeah, something like that. Great times in Japan.
Yeah, because back then, a lot of you went to Japan, didn't you? Because
there was already a great community of drivers in Japan. I mean, Jeff Lee's AL being the first, obviously. Yeah. But then there was a whole bunch of drivers with Mauro Martini, Eddie Irvine, Ross Chiva, Jeff Krosnoff, Roland Ratzenberger. Maybe I forgot some, but I mean, Andrew Gilbert Scott. There's a lot of very good drivers, more than I mentioned, which were having a platform in Japan. Formula 3 going through Toms, Victor Rosso, Paolo Kakaski, and then Richard Rydell, Jacques Villeneuve, and myself. We were signed at Tom's Toyota for the same season, and joining Tetsuya Tanaka in let's say we were 4 drivers under the Tom banners at different teams.
What's amazing is just listening to you for the last few minutes is this was a period of incredibly competitive. There were so many of you just at that level, weren't there?
Yeah, and Japan had so much, you know, fantastic circuits and the infrastructure of being a lot of, I mean, car manufacturers alone, but tire manufacturers and fan base. Yeah. It was a lovely time too. Japan, I owe so much to fulfill my successful life because after winning the German F3, you know, going into European 3000 again and all these things, you need a budget. I had no budget. So Japan was really a great way of understanding and driving for somebody who put an effort in to having poor me to be part of the team. And that's something which gives you commitment and gives you dedication. Try to do the best you can, even though that you are at that time. It's before social media. I think I think telex. We were just going into telefax. Yeah. But I remember that when I got a telefax, I better read it within 5 or 6 days. Otherwise, it turns completely yellow, and you might not be able to read it. So that's how we got we got the news, and then we were far away, let's say, during these times. But we had fantastic times, great camaraderie. The drivers, we are called gaijins in Japan, we had great camaraderie, of course, with the Japanese too. But it takes time.
And wasn't one of the drivers over there with you was Jacques Villeneuve? And you spent quite a lot of time with him, didn't you? And I seem to remember I was reading Lunch With that Simon did with you, and I seem to remember you ended up sharing a bed with him at one point. Is that right?
Yeah,
sorry, that was probably a little bit direct, but
I don't think you find this in Wikipedia. I think somebody must. You have good friends, and I certainly don't. Haven't. No, it's true. I mean, that story, to cut it short, it was Villeneuve and me were doing that Formula 3, fighting for the championship. One time, we were then asked if we would join in the last race of the All Nippon Group C Championship at Mine. We would then join Eddie Irvine. They will make a young car with Villeneuve and me, and there was a test at Suzuka, and we had to go straight to a test in Mine to prepare for this one, and then we were going by the Shinkansen, the fast train, but we had to change at a station which we missed up. It was the wrong station where we got off trying to change, and the only thing we could do, we could then end up, I don't know, around midnight at Hiroshima instead of I forgot the other but anyway, we were in Hiroshima, and the next one we could get was then 5:40 in the morning, so we had to find a place to stay. And the first hotel we come in, I made the mistake that Jack went first, and he goes up to the desk and say, do you have rooms, and they look a bit at him and at me. No, there was no rooms, unfortunately. But then I came with the idea, if they could call another hotel, if they had a room available, and they had, but they had just had a double room, that was the only thing, and they said, we'd take it. But obviously, you have to remember Jack back then, he had long hair, and he had these round glasses, similar to yours, Rob, but just they were round, and you know, with the long hair, and with me, and people, they were getting the wrong impressions already back then.
It's a nice story there.
We made the test, and it was a fantastic. That was the Toyota TSO10, Tony Southcott design. Great car. V10 engine, normally aspirated, powerful like a lot. It was really great times.
Nice story there, isn't it? It's good. We must ask Jacques about it one day. you did European F3, but at this point, this was tell me if I'm wrong, but it was a bit of a turning point, because you went to do an IndyCar test. Did it appeal to you or not?
It was the test was then at the short circuit at Sebring.
Yeah.
It did. It was great, powerful car. It was a Reinhard Mercedes from Bettenhausen, Carponche, Magnus, Jörg Müller,
yes,
and myself. We had a day each. I think we had four standard medium tires and two sets of soft tires, and I enjoyed and had a perfect day. I was told it was the fastest over these 4 days, and things looked good. But as always, the budget requires, I guess. And Carponche went on and had a brilliant career in IndyCar, and
sure,
I went on to something else. But for me to test, we had a great time there, and very powerful tool. And yes, if I had got the nod, I would certainly have accepted and gone for that route.
And when you were growing up and sort of getting into motorsport, was it F1 that you wanted to get to, or was it a career in motorsport? Or, you know, because you obviously went to the Indy test and might have done Indy. Were you still very much F1 at that stage, or when did the sports cars come in?
No, I've always had the sort of the dream of F1, but being realistic, I mean, you heard earlier with my mom, and I've seen my dad struggle. I mean, I believe he was a very, very great talent, but obviously never had the fundament to make his career. So I've always been very realistic about that. I've always been very, very sure that the people who gave me opportunities or chances, I make sure that very much I thank them, look them very much in the eyes, and understand that they are giving me a help to my future career. So with that sense, I can ask kindly to things, but being very focused and going, say you just want to focus on Formula One, that appeals to me to be very arrogant. And at the same time, I think motorsport in general gives and bodes for so much more when you are trying all the different categories. And I'm absolutely happy to have jumped on every chance over these years, which has given me great experience, life experience, and meeting people, yeah. And that has been absolutely great. But you can say, yeah, it's sort of sometimes it's two steps back and one step forward, but again, it gives great experience. And I think also nowadays of younger drivers, if you don't make it next year, you won't make it. I mean, I don't agree. You know, motorsport is so much more than that, and you should not be too extreme down the one alley to what you want to achieve. For there's so much more, and motorsport I think today is so wide, particularly with all the junior formulas, and of course that makes it very difficult when you just focus for going into Formula One. But I think now. Nowadays, I mean, the WEC is coming on incredibly well. Yeah. And of course, touring car have a big part as well. And you see so many successful drivers going into GT, which makes this very, very competitive event too.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, you, as things turned out, you had a much longer career at the very top in sports car racing than you would have had in Formula One. I mean, your career has been extraordinary duration at the top level, hasn't it? That's very rare in Formula One.
It's true, but it goes in generation. You get in, and then you as you're doing a good job, you stay longer, and that's true. I mean, but for me, thanks to Audi arriving at Audi, I mean, then you realize that that's something very special, and that's you. I can tell you with not. You simply feel with that growing with that team over all these years. It has been, of course, under the leadership of Dr. Ulrich. But there are so many people who has come and joined and creating such a good karma at Audi Sport. Yeah. And look how big it is today. Yeah. So of course I don't know anyone or everyone by first name. But when I started there in 2000, I think the group of people were just breaking 150, and now it's a lot more people.
Yeah. Okay, 1997 was your first time at Le Mans. Tell me about that. Tell me, what was your first reaction, your first gut feeling about the place, about the track, about the extraordinary event it is?
You know, I was contacted on Wednesday night before, basically like 10 days before the race or 5 days before the event. Then I got the call when I was on the bicycle from Ralf Jüttner, if I was interested. The next day, of course, I was interested. I realized it was with Stefan Johansson, with Michele Alboreto. It's a one-car team. And I flew down to the team on Friday, meeting Reinhold Joest and Ralf Jüttner, and one of the mechanics Jürgen Hurt, and then they invited me to fly down on Sunday with them to the circuit. And everything happened so fast. I mean, just after I signed the contract, I then informed on the way back that I had to do a test at the A1 ring, the Red Bull ring, it's called now, in Austria. So actually, I had for my own money to rent his private plane to fly after the first practice on Wednesday. I went to bed before the briefing and woke up at 5, flew on Thursday to A1 ring to do the second day of F3000 test there. And to arrive back at the circuit when the session were already started and having to do my night session. So I only got 17 timed laps before my first Le Mans start. And that's, as you know, before the simulators or before anything else. And that was, I had definitely some adrenaline before the start.
Your first impressions of the track, because I mean it's so different from probably anything else that you had raced up until then.
It's long. It's fast. It takes. You sort of build up. At that time, there was no runoff. I would say. At no places. I mean, it was still the old S's. When you come down through Dunlop, you went straight down to the SS, Tête Rouge. It was a nice character building up of that of these 17 timed laps I had before the race started. And the interview I give after I jump out of the car in the evening was, I spoke quite fast, and I think you don't. I mean, you know, it's not the same like today when these great youngsters are coming and joining. They know them. It takes them a few laps, then they are there. They have done the simulator, they have done the pretest. Yes. All these things has changed over these years to the good. Definitely, I carried some pressure. I had no telemetry. Actually, that was a private team of years, so they had no data from previous years. So it was from speaking to particularly Michele, because he did many laps of the pretest. It was basically him. I went around on the scooter with him, but he couldn't really tell. I think it's third, maybe second. But you know, that was how it. That was sort of how it developed. But at night, I got into the groove, and then the confidence and the whole build up started. And when I was asked to in the third stint, if I could do a fourth stint, and Jüttner being on the radio, schnellste Runde, Tom, schnellste Runde, Rundenrekord. Keep it calm, keep it steady. That's nice. That's the best thing you can hear as a driver when you have been working very hard over. And I used too much effort in the car. You know, I was holding the steering wheel too hard. The seat. I told when Jürgen Hurt, when I was there sitting in the spare monocoque when I was visiting the team on Friday. You know, I said I sit perfect. It's perfect. The car is for me. It's a Michele's seat. It fits me perfect. Maybe if I can have the brake pedal a little bit back, it will be perfect. And then he just goes down to my head and whispers loudly, "The fastest this side at our place." And I was I was all put in a lot of respect. So obviously it was great. We won the race. Michele and Stefan. And the team, we did an incredible job. And then I never forget that little barbecue we had after, where they have their Weissbier, they have the the Frankfurters, the Bockwurst, everything on the grill. Just when I had half a beer, I was so tired of sitting in the car, which I was not really fit for me. But being the youngest in the team, I thought it's time now to put the finger in the bag of Jürgen. And I just found him and I said, "Jürgen, next year, brake pedal a bit back, please." that's sort of the highlight of my beginning at Le Mans, because I learned so much over that week that you probably do, or I probably had done an entire school year in my late teens.
Did you realize how big an achievement it was to go to Le Mans and win first time out? I mean, obviously some people have done it, but you know, people go in years and years and years and never even finish on the podium. I mean, it was obviously such a monumental achievement, but having never been there, it might not have sunk in, I guess.
It had. Let's say back in Denmark, I mean, the motor world knew and followed it, but there was one newspaper which put it on the front of the sport and said now Tom might want to quit his job in the bank now, not knowing that I had been 5 years professional, first in Germany and in Japan. So for sure it's an eye opener. Le Mans simply just blows. Yeah. The doors open to the whole world, and being a talent or go-kart champion or Formula 3 winner or German 3 winner or whatever, putting the name associated Le Mans winner has made things so much easier. So it's a great privilege in motorsport to have that title along with it. Absolutely,
it's a wonderful story, actually, Tom. That whole That was an amazing weekend. Was looking back, I mean, okay, you got a chance with Williams, but in the Le Mans car, with the BMW engine. Did you think, well, you know, maybe a Williams Formula One might come along, or was it always made clear from the word go that wasn't possible?
I had a few Formula One tests back then, but I mean, suddenly I got the call. It was from Frank personally on my answering machine. I would like you to call me back, and I will have a good chance for you to test at Magny-Cours. So please call me as soon as you can. Thank you.
I bet you did.
That's lovely. Obviously, I did, and I made sure I was alone in the room when I called him. And yes, it's something which is great. I mean, I followed things like that. His team, I would have been fantastic to race for his team. He was involved when we did the BMW, the sports prototype. So I think that's where the link how it all started. But yes, it didn't mature. It could have. Obviously, a lot of drivers were going in that direction, and still my nationality is something I'm proud of, but it doesn't necessarily have been helping me in this sport in certainly in the early days.
It's interesting because have you actually ever had any financial support from Denmark?
I mean, I've been let off at my dentist, my bill a few times. My dad have paid my fuel, but always only one way. There has been a Shell gave me, I think, 1,700 sterling for Formula 3 test once. That's about it in the junior formulas. But I was working in the bank, and obviously the bank went, unfortunately, because it was a very proud bank for my little town. Went bankrupt a few years after I left it, but that's certainly a coincidence.
It's a wonderful country. I love it. I have many friends there. You still live there. You've built a new house there.
I've been in Denmark again for 4 years. Yeah. Unfortunately, I have lost my parents over this 2011, 2013. So it was very, very important. We as a family has been there, and we don't want to, let's say, go away again for life. We will like to live a little bit in the States, but we want to have our roots nicely. Sure. at Hobro, and our house is actually just finished now in the next 3 or 4 weeks. So we look back of making instead of apartments or other things, we look forward very much to make our own place in the world our own.
Yeah, absolutely exciting.
It's good sort of rewinding back to Le Mans in the late 90s, early 2000s. Am I right in thinking that you were approached by Audi and they showed you the designs of the R8, and then you signed on? You literally signed having seen the designs of the new car, or
it's quite clear. Let's say we win in 97, winning with Joost. Then the following year.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There was suddenly a lot of opportunities at table. I went with BMW, hoping a little bit about what Rob asked about before, to compare. You had both the F1 leg and you had the Le Mans leg there, and I stayed with them for 2 years. Then I did Honda as well in Super Touring and BTCC, yeah, at the same time as these with BMW was focused on Le Mans, Sebring, and that's it. But then from 2000. I went during 99, where we had the biggest lead at Le Mans I've ever had, yeah, with Müller and JJ. We won Sebring and then leading at Le Mans until I think 3-4 hours to the end, yeah, when JJ had a suspension failure, a damper broken, and we retired. But we were next pit to Audi at that time, and Audi was there for the first time. And I've made arrangement with Doug Rulick to see him in the office in late autumn in 99. And he showed me then a drawing of this R8, what the car everyone knows about. But it was just a drawing. And by what he told me of the human, of what they want to achieve, I gave him my handshake as, of course, not the first drivers, as Bela Piro and others were already there. But that was the car I then joined for the following three seasons.
At the time, you couldn't possibly have known just what a fantastic move it was to join Audi. I mean, you couldn't have ever imagined. I guess you couldn't have imagined.
That's why I say it's the best thing I've ever done in my mature life as a racing driver. That also shows you have to go with your gut feelings. Gut feelings is what you can make things. And the gut feeling with Ulrich that time was that. And I remember doing it. Thanks God he took my hand on that, and that's I could not imagine, but it was a gut feeling. But as a driver, is quite short-sighted, but when you look back over 15 great years with the best manufacturing in the world, it has been, as I said earlier, a fantastic time to be part of this unique atmosphere there is when people are buzzing for ideas, buzzing for passion, for trying to go fast in the right way.
I think, Rob, you might correct me on this one, but I think it was Piro, Emanuele, who said that the R8 was one of the greatest cars he ever drove. And I've heard other drivers say that as well.
McNish said that.
Yeah. Is that, do you agree with them?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's I would say the greatest car I ever drove is probably our 2013 R18 e-tron quattro, due to under the regulations. But if you look over a time span of 5-6 years, the R8 won Le Mans 5 times, won a lot of races at different places. I mean, personally, I'm privileged to all the Le Mans wins with the R8, all the Le Mans wins Audi had, I was one of the drivers. And so for me, it is the car, which means the most to me. And then it became a sort of a road car, badged car from Audi after that. Yeah. So it has an enormous fundament and success behind what was started, or from the ideas, from the sketch I was shown at Dr. Ulrich's office in 1999.
And going on from the R8 and the diesel, when you were first told about that, what were your immediate reactions? Because surely as a racing driver, it would have been no thanks.
Yeah, it was kind of that. It was in the middle. That's why I said the three official years with R8 was with Bila Piro. Then I was personally with Bentley, Capello, and Guy Smith, winning in 2003.
Yeah.
And then in 2004 and 5, I drove for the Japanese R8 team, Team Go. And in 2005 with Champion Racing, the American team. So for me, it was great. I had a bit of America, I had a bit of Japan, I had a bit of Audi, and obviously at Le Mans. So I was in a great circle. But it was these two private years we started to hear a little bit of whisper that our crazy engine guru Beretsky on with a project about diesel. So in the beginning, I said, yeah, for sure. he will put out one of his jokes. But then I heard it again, and I talked to him, and he said, "Seriously, it's that's possible. That's what we are working very hard at that." Then I started to think my retirement might be a little bit early, because I think with a diesel, if we have to go through the development of course, I'm grown up with my dad's brother. They are having what do you call it? when lorries, they have lorries driving around, so I know a lot about diesel and how
transport
it's certainly not going very fast, but Beretsky convinced a little bit. He said that we can do something, but you have to would we probably have to accept a little bit of sort of center of gravity and weight distribution, having to go back a little bit in racing, because we need a lot of weight at the rear in the drivetrain, the gearbox, the drive shaft, everything, to make up for all that torque that comes out of this V12 TDI engine, which was enormous torque. Yeah. It was very, very much a beast. So that's the wildest car I've ever driven in terms of it was just important to make sure to point it in the right direction. It understeered because we had to use a spool, try to stabilize the car when we were braking going into corners, and also just to stabilize that you had really not a monkey on your back, you had a whole gorilla family in the beginning, and then you just had to point it in the right direction, and then when you just opened, just took off, unbelievable. And that was so I would say the most drivable car in these days, the R8. But the R10 became very much very, very difficult beast to handle, particularly in the early days, and it just became better and better. But of course, winning Le Mans 2008 is one of our greatest achievements. Capello, Magnussen with Audi, so that's why that car also have a little bit of, you can say, both fear but also but also pleasure in my mind.
Sorry, Rob. Just rewinding a bit, because obviously the Bentley, we skipped over that. Was that not your first time in a closed cockpit sports car? How was that? Because you'd been driving open tops for quite a number of years. And I
like open tops in that sense. But I mean, everyone thought that was first time I was in a closed car. But actually, I did that race in Mina with Villeneuve and Irvine in the Toyota TSO10. I did some testing with them, traction control testing at the Yamaha test circuit. If you speak about dangerous circuits and young drivers trying to go for their ambition, you know, going 330 through a long left-hander. But I have been in a closed car before. But certainly the Bentley is probably, as I said, the most, it's the most beautiful car I've ever driven. And sitting inside, it gives you a little bit of, in terms of visibility, you have the windscreen far away, but you don't have the buffeting. It's quite pleasant, unless it's 30 degrees, hot summer day, because then it can start to boil. But certainly I like also the privilege of being in a closed cockpit.
It was around this time that you met, well, not met, but it was on a podium somewhere with Alan. And you've been fighting. Or it was 12 hours. Was it Sebring?
It was Sebring, but that was in the, we were teammates in the Champion Racing.
Yeah.
And Champion, you know, Dave Mirage, he likes the free spirit, like, and actually Ulrich does as well at Audi. And that we had Kettler was our engineer, and the other car were having everything free. And it was short fueling, no tires or new tires or tires on the left side, tires not. It was a great race to the end, and we happened to win by 13 seconds. It could have been the other way around or whatever, but you know, just the joy of a great race, and Alan and me finishing the last, I think, 2.5 hours. We were
neck and neck,
and always up the other way around. We did it. Fresh tires. We were reeling the other one in, the other way around. So. At the podium, or actually at the celebration after, we told that, hey, our dads were there, and we agreed that to help our dads in future, it would be better to put us in the same car, because they were great friends, and obviously having a good time and a few beers as you have at Sebring, and that was when we decided that we'll speak to Dr. Ulrich. And this was 5, so actually in 6 when we started with the TDI or the diesel, we were then joined with Dindo Capello, who Alan had previously been teammate with, and when Alan left for Formula One, I was then a teammate with him. So it was also, it was a nice circle, and made sense for Dr. Ulrich to put that back in when the works team went back towards Le Mans with a new program.
It's become it's a piece of sports car racing history, that team, actually, those three drivers. What is it about the chemistry between the three of you? And tell us a bit about how important is that, Tom, that you have that sort of something special?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's three very, very different personalities, but with the same goal. And that's why we have there's easy space for all of us. We have fun together. I mean, we need to be together. Or certainly, we need to travel with Dindo. Otherwise, it will soon be a two car team. He will not be able to go to the same place. And I need to bring the money, because certainly otherwise we won't get any food. And you know, that's the way we work. And I'm sure you will, when you see one of the other two, they will have a better answer again. But we are great friends, and we still, even though that we are different parts of the world now, we always communicate.
Your book has arrived, Tom. Your book. This is 3 kilos worth of Tom Christensen's story. It's fantastic. Let's have a. I mean, this is. There are some great pictures here. So tell us. Well, first of all, tell us how the book came about, because.
The book came about in the weeks after I've decided to retire, and then and people have mentioned it before, but I think it was no time to look back, but suddenly now it made sense. Yeah. I could open another chapter to close it, and to make a coffee table book with pictures from my debut at Le Mans, or from it's covering the whole thing, from being born on the gas station, as I started earlier.
Let's have a look. It's a great thing to have, isn't it? Great thing to have. Wow. Okay, so but this book now is available. Oh, look at that! That's a fantastic picture, isn't it? Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's my dad with the helmet.
Lovely picture.
That's where the Shell gas station. I'm almost home born up there. That's my dad driving. I mean, you can see the determination in him in an Escort Mark 1.
Brilliant. That's a good picture, isn't it? Yeah. Gosh. Quite an emotional book for you, actually, I'd have thought.
It's very, and it to be working over that, it became suddenly, as you know in your business, that I would love to have a lot more pictures in the book. And
you sound like the art designers at Motorsport.
Yes, we
do. Yeah, but I had speed pool in Hamburg to help me, and I drove down there once or twice was planned, but I think I ended up being there 7 times. And I think Lars Kroner, who has edited the book, I think he was very happy that the deadline when the deadline was I think the third deadline was finally dead.
Actually, it is lovely. Eh?
Yeah.
And have a proper look at it. Okay, let.
Yeah, available in all good bookstores, I guess.
Hey, on the kart. Here's the karting. Yeah, that's great. I love kart racing, don't you? It's great.
Certainly. Mika Häkkinen.
Oh, right. Yes, look at that. Wow. Brilliant. God, this is fantastic. Yeah, karting's great. Tom, let's have a look at the front cover because we're on video, Alan, aren't we? We are. So we should just, if you just, it's 3 kilos. So I don't want to drop it. But anyway, this is the book.
It's 3.5, but
3.5 kilos to be precise.
So you can use it for CrossFit too.
It's available now, and I must say I'd like to have a look at it. So there's Tom's book, fantastic. A lot of work in there, actually, Tom. We have got some questions from our readers and our listeners, obviously. And if we start with Chris Seawood. He wants to know, what was your favourite ever time at Le Mans? Was it during the week before the race, or scrutineering, or the podium, or what was the bit that you really used to, apart from winning, okay, the bit that you really love about being there?
Yeah, but Le Mans is so special. It's basically everything. But if the moment, I think that's when it's going well at night and you feel the plan works and you are in the... You're in the groove, you're in the zone, and everything is going in the right direction. That's absolutely that's the best. When you know that you are doing the best you can and everything works, then you're on, because then...
Yeah, I can imagine that, because actually I spoke to Nico Hülkenberg about driving the Porsche, and he said his favorite time was at night with just the lights in the cockpit, the lights by the switches, just him, the car, and you know, he said it's an absolutely unbelievable feeling.
Yeah, a very good description. But that's that I think is a moment of full of adrenaline and the pure passion, and then you obviously you feel that you're on it that time. That's you have now what so many people have worked for. Underneath you.
Yeah, because we haven't mentioned that. I mean, the team effort is, especially at Audi, I mean, the teamwork is fantastic, isn't it?
The first time when I was there, there's 12 people on that one car team of mechanics and engineer with the Joost Porsche. And when you see it nowadays, I mean, Audi, I think there's 147 on the pictures with 3 cars on the picture this year. So that has always also been... and a massive development over the years of effort, what takes to compete at the highest level.
Sure. We have another question. We're not at an airport, by the way. We're at the Goodwood Revival, the day before the Goodwood Revival. So there are a few planes around. Friendly planes. This comes from Victor, and he makes the point that over your career in sports cars, the changes in technology have been absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, it's a relentless march forwards. As a driver, is that just something that you say, okay, we've got the diesel, we get on with it. Okay, we've got this, or you have to get quite involved in understanding all the new technology, don't you?
Yeah, and I think we as drivers feel quite privileged as well over all these years. I mean, I know the technicians with us, experienced drivers, they know that we are 100%. On the case and giving the feedback which we feel, but to have been around normal aspirated engine, TDI engine, FSI engine, and then going to the e-tron and then going with the latest regulative of let's say the efficiency with the hybrid and with that energy capacity you are allowed to use per lap like we had last year or what we have now from my last year.
Because there's a lot to think about there, isn't
it? It has been a lot. I've gone from, let's say, right foot braking to left foot braking to coasting to having a car which is a very racy, oversteery car to an understeery R10. All these things. It has been a great journey, but it has also been that made our Audi drivers, as you mentioned, there's a lot of great drivers who have been there for a longer time because we have been motivated, we have been passionate about it, because we have been in a time where we are able to there's always
something new
and yeah, you want yeah, to yeah, feel yeah, that yeah. or you want yeah, to yeah. to master that, and that has been a great privilege for us. But these cars from the R8, and I actually drove the very first R8 in Sebring as well, it's with the 99 car as preparation for 2000, and me and Alan actually. So from that time, I've been in all the Audi sports cars, and that has been obviously a great privilege.
Do you drive one on the road, by the way? Do you have an Audi on the road?
Yeah, but I have a great, let's say, a large family. So the R8 is is mainly with me and my little son, and we go for some short drives. But as you know, from Audi, you can even get a station wagon, very powerful, and this one is the preferred one at the moment.
Okay,
Who would you say your toughest competitor was throughout your career? Whether that's a person or maybe another car at Le Mans. Is there anyone that sort of pops to the front of your mind as being someone you always thought, right, I've got to watch out for them?
The main thing is you very much always have to watch out for yourself. You have to make sure that yourself and your team and the teammates, that is very much the I believe, the key. But there have been great rivalry at Le Mans or in sport cars over all these years. And respectful rivalry. It's difficult to mention. Every year it changes. There has been a lot. I mean, it was the works, let's say 97, it was the works Porsches when we did with BMW. Then it was Mercedes, it was Nissan, the works Porsches again. And then Audi was joining, and when I joined Audi, obviously 2000. There was from Cadillac and from Panas was a little bit less in 2000 in the early years. But then it started to be. There was three cars. Then we had the
Peugeot Indo, came along as well.
Then the independent team. When we were there with R8, there was quite a lot of private teams. Doing the R8s at the same time with Pescarolo, and Pescarolo were probably the biggest favorite for winning in 2000 and 4 and 5.
Yeah.
And then Peugeot came, and we had great racing with them. Toyota came, and now Porsche came. And there's always been a great rivalry over all the years.
Yeah. Okay, we must take another question from all the people who support us by listening to our podcasts and reading our magazine. Diego Ruiz Villamil, he wants to know, Tom, what's the most frightening moment you've ever had in your career? Racing drivers are always asked this. I mean, is there a moment that stands out for you when you thought, whoa, I was lucky there?
The moment which comes to my mind right now, it's pre-qualifying in 98. I'm going down towards coming out of Mulsanne. The circuit was wet in the morning. I've just put on intermediates, and I'm on a lap. And it's pre-qualifying. There's one session in the morning for the uneven, and obviously for even in the afternoon or something like that. And there's just a little bit around an hour left. And as I go up to top gear, and I come around the kink, which is flat, and there is a dry line obviously appearing. I just feel that the car doesn't turn, and immediately I'm with the left foot on the brakes, and it doesn't turn, and then I go on the grass, and I just make, and obviously the grass is wet, and I'm more than 300. I'm 317 when we check later, and then I just touch the barrier a little bit, make it around. I mean, there was no runoff into India at that time, but I just skate a little bit on the AMCO, but just brush it briefly, And boom, 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 boom. My heart is like that. And I'm coming into the pit. And obviously my teammates, Hans-Joachim Stuck and Steve Sober, they're there, they're ready. I'm going in and I'm the radio. I say, I have a big problem. Car didn't turn. I didn't turn. I'm thinking about it. I think I have a lift. But, you know, it's very visible, difficult to see. Team is under pressure. Everyone is looking around. And the engineer comes to me, and my Italian engineer, and he said, I don't think there's a problem. Everything looks okay. And, I jump out of the car, and I say, there is a problem. We have to check again. Then at the same time I jump out, I mean, Patrick Head comes around the corner, and he asks me to come in. And we then look at the data. And obviously there is, and he tells the mechanics to look for. And something, and at the same time, I say to Steve and Hans, if you want to qualify, now it's your time. It's funny. I mean, somebody just walked around the corner. But Patrick realized that the car took off, and what seems there was a manufacturer problem with the floor, so something from outside. With the shimming was wrong. So actually at that time, it was first time I went more than 300 as it was raining at that day, and the floor split and it came then air hole underneath it, and they fixed it, got out, and the circuit dried out. I had on slicks and we qualified. But that was frightened twice. That was the second time I go down, but when Patrick had and he found it and they made sure it was clear, I jumped in again and it worked.
Whoa, okay. Yes, yeah, Steve Soper is sitting just a few yards away from us, coincidentally. Anyway, here's a last question from Ed H, Tom, and it's, who would be your ultimate driver lineup to drive with you at Le Mans, regardless of era? You can choose anybody from any time.
No, but it's a very, I mean, I cannot, I take so much time to think, and if I mention some, it's simply not fair. I have been privileged of driving with the best drivers in the world, and all my teammates have made an incredible effort, and obviously some have driven with longer than others, but everyone have been a very great part of me, and it's, I think it's a great question, but it's a question which can't be answered. I normally say the perfect teammate is is 25 kilos light. She's good looking, and she only say yes, I will do that, and then does it. And obviously, is incredibly consistent, incredibly fast. That's sort of the best I can have, and quite a few have been close to that, I would have to say.
We get the picture. Okay, it's been such a pleasure talking to you as always. We're here at Goodwood at the Goodwood Revival. You've had some famous races here. I thought you were going to mention the Austin Westminster as your most frightening moment, actually, but anyway, you didn't.
No, I mean, that was only positive. There was no frightening moment in that car.
No, it looked frightening. From the outside, that's all.
No, anyway. that was
that was one of your finest races.
Yeah, I love that. Ford Galaxy also, yeah. In the St. Mary's. I mean, but I think, I mean, Goodwood. What an event! Yeah. I mean, that's to go back in history once a year like that. Okay, now I haven't been here for 2 years, but. It feels like last year I was here still. It's a great event, and yeah. This year I made sure I came a day earlier, just to see the whole build up and how they do it.
Sure. Just briefly, tell us, what are you doing at the Revival this year? What wonderful things have you been given to do?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, is the only rule I have is that I always drive different cars.
Yeah.
And then I always say, unless they are sure winning cars. But I don't want to go down that route. So I always been here in different cars, and I haven't driven them before. And And that, I think, is how it should be.
Yeah.
I know it is a little bit different. The only car I drove before the race was my first visit here was actually the Austin Westminster. Yeah, yeah. And then I did also the Cobra, AC Cobra with Kenny Bragg. I drove that before the event as well. Otherwise, I've come to the event, seen the car, saying hello to the owner, to the co-driver, to the team, and then I enjoy the weekend. And of course, the first lap, I'm not impressing anyone, but that's how I like it. And that's how I think it really it really should be.
Yeah.
This time, some people put the faith in me in a Lister Jaguar from 1963. In my history, I thought it was the car was older, but I think it's to do with a different configuration the car started in. And then Henry Mann, my dad loves the Mann Escorts, the Escort Mark 1s.
Yeah,
you saw it in the book with my dad. So my father has been here with me, and we have talked a lot about history with him. So I'm sure he will follow me up there. That
Brilliant.
I'm actually driving with Alan Mann's son Henry, and it's a Ford it's a Ford Fairlane, and I haven't seen that yet. I've seen the Lister Jaguar. I've just been sitting in it, but I'm going afterwards to trying to find this this Ford Fairlane.
You have to take care at Goodwood, don't you? It's very fast. Not a huge amount of runoff. I mean, it's a historic circuit.
Very much so. And again, team, the preparation and the sort of the excellent money which is spent into optimizing these cars, both for being fast and also for being safe. It's in good hands. The historic. You know that much better than me, the historic world and how it works. But there's a lot of very efficient teams and good people who actually even have found a sort of better living in this part of motorsport than in maybe the up-and-coming motorsports, which we have talked a lot about before.
Sure.
So it definitely shown that the historic motorsport is the heritage of motorsport, and that's why we participate. This is the best event worldwide to do that. So to be here again, it's a privilege. And again, sorry, Mom, I retired last year, but but this I'm just doing for fun, and here I go once a year.
Thank you very much, really, for giving us all your time today, and have a great weekend. Take care.
Thank you.
And let's just remind everybody about the book, because it is now available, 3.5 kilos, and there it is.
It's actually quite easily remembered. It's called The
Book. It's called The Book. Nice and simple. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in again, for joining us on our Motorsport Magazine podcast. It's great to have you all with us. I hope we answered your questions fully. Tom's usually pretty good at that. And we'll be back very soon with our next edition. And don't forget also to stay with us on our website, where lots of things are happening, thanks to Ed, our website editor. There's always something new, almost every day. It's amazing. There's a video or an audio or some good story. Fantastic. And that's obviously at motorsportmagazine.com. In fact, of course, there is a video of me and Tom Christensen at Le Mans in an Audi R8. Me looking frightened, him looking like he's going to the shops on a Sunday afternoon. Good.
But you were driving, Rob, no? Yeah.
Yes, I was driving, really. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.